You're listening to the On the NBA Beat podcast, a show packed with nuanced perspectives on the league's most important stories.
Portland has three timeouts left. The Lakers have two. Bryant to Shaq.
LeBron James with no regard for human life.
Jordan. Oh, a spectacular move by Michael Jordan.
And now, your hosts, Lauren Lee Chen, and the twins, Aaron and Joshua Fisher.
Thanks for tuning in. This is On the NBA Beat, and I'm Aaron Fishman. As you can see, as you can hear, our long hiatus is over. And for the first show back, we have a book special with Ethan Shiner, a professor of political science at UC Davis, and the author of Freedom to Win, a Cold War story of the courageous hockey team that fought the Soviets for the soul of its people and Olympic gold. Now, clearly it's not a basketball book, but I've decided to bring this discussion onto the show because this long-form narrative tells a fascinating, important, and timely story that tightly links politics and sports. One of my two majors at Davis was political science, and I was fortunate enough to have Ethan as a professor twice while there over a decade ago. Given that Ethan is a new guest, it wouldn't be right not to share a fun fact about him. As a transfer student, he was admitted to UC Santa Cruz as a swimmer. There, Ethan became the first male member of the Banana Slug swim team with any real prior competitive experience. He served as the first and only male captain those first 2 years, in 88-89 and 89-90. And for his first year in town, he held something like all but one school record. Naturally, to quote Ethan, those records, quote, disappeared instantly the next year when they got good swimmers. Without further ado, enjoy this expansive and captivating discussion with Ethan. It's terrific, and so is he.
Ethan, such a great book that you wrote. I'm excited to get into it. How's it going this morning?
It is awesome. Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for the kind words about the book.
My pleasure. Let's just get into it before wasting any more time. Such an educational book, but just so fun and fascinating, and it's a perfect marriage of sports and politics, your expertise. So we'll just take advantage of this time that we have with you and try to soak up as much knowledge as we can. You did mention it at the beginning of the acknowledgements, just the inspiration for the book, the genesis of the project. You were, I believe, inspired by Breakaway, that book by Tal Pinchevsky, and you needed something for your students, your new class syllabus material. Just tell me a little bit more about that, and then once the idea got started, what were the first steps that you undertook?
Yeah, and you actually put it perfectly. I mean, the thing that actually is so incredible about this story, it is an unbelievable marriage of politics and sports. I mean, that really is the thing that jumps right out. And so I'm a professor of political science. As you know, I don't know if you're telling the listener, but Aaron was a student of mine many, many years ago in a class, if I remember right, on, I believe it was comparative electoral systems.
I took two classes with you, and then also Japanese politics too.
Okay, that's right. I forgot about that. So that's exactly right. I used to work a lot on Japanese politics. I used to work a lot on comparative electoral systems. And right now, the listener is going to sleep as I start talking about this. and so one of the things is that was what I was a specialist on. I wrote books and articles on that. And I thought, okay, I want to do something a little different just for fun. And I decided I'd teach a class on politics and sports. And early on in the class, you know, some things were obvious. Like, of course, I was going to do Jesse Owens in the Olympics, and I was going to do things like Jackie Robinson, and I was going to do the Miracle on Ice. But I was quickly realizing that once I tried to push things more, this was going to be a class about stuff in the Cold War. And if I started to do other countries, I didn't really actually know that much about all of this. And I started to really freak out as I started to, you know, try and figure out what was I going to teach on. And so I'm poking around here and there, and everything I was finding was just kind of symbolic. Nothing seemed to be having a real impact. Like, the sports didn't really, really impact politics, and the politics didn't really, really impact the sports. And I was sitting there going, I don't know what I'm going to teach. And so completely freaked out. One night, I can't sleep. And I get up and I find this book that you talked about, a book, Breakaway by Tal Pinchevsky, about guys who defected from Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union to go play hockey in the NHL. And I'm sitting there as I start reading it, thinking this is amazing, because the opening of the book talks about this amazing story where this communist country, Czechoslovakia, which had started to become free, suddenly got invaded by the Soviet Union. You know, the Soviet Union said, we're not going to allow this country to become free. And so all of a sudden, the people of this little country were crushed. And they found that there was only one way they could fight back. That is, the Soviets were too powerful militarily. There are 500,000 troops, you know, in front of the Czechoslovaks. And so the people of Czechoslovakia said, you know what, though? We're about to play the Soviets in the World Ice Hockey Championships. And people in Czechoslovakia love hockey. And so they turned their whole world into supporting their team to try and fight back against the Soviets on the ice. And I just sat there going, this is actually politics and sports completely overlapping. I think this is the greatest story I've ever heard. And I had to stop because it was only 8 pages in Tal's book and there wasn't any more information. And I decided I was going to drop it. I couldn't do any more with it. I didn't end up teaching it at first, but I became obsessed because it was such a great story. And from there, I went and started doing research, deciding I was going to write a book.
It is a remarkable story. And clearly, it demonstrates how sports can just be so much more. And just the impact is just so far-reaching of something that's happening with a puck on ice. It's so much more than that. And you'll help illuminate that for us as this discussion unfolds. But you were referencing the Prague Spring in part of your response there in 1968. And the narrative that you unfurl for us starts decades before then. And you do a great job of setting the tone and providing the context. But if you can, I'd love for you to detail the challenges that were involved in reporting on events that transpired so long ago, and also getting into the minds and heads and hearts of these characters that are either no longer alive or they're a lot older in life and memories can be fuzzy, as we well know.
Yeah, so the trickiest part is I don't speak Czech or Slovak. And these are people who, you know, that's most of them don't speak English. And so, as you alluded to, I actually interviewed a lot of people for this book, a lot of people, and especially people who are, you know, pushing at this point 80 years of age, and some even older than that. And so, yeah, I had to get into what all these different events meant to these different individuals. And so that was tricky. And so I worked a bunch with an interpreter when I went and visited the Czech Republic and Slovakia. I mean, by far the greatest interviews I did were with people who spoke English. But the ones with the older people, it was really necessary to have that translator. And so that was harder for sure, especially as, you know, in some cases, the memories were fuzzy. So one of the star players, I asked him about games, and he said, you know, I barely remember anything about games. And this is a guy who actually, one of the key characters in the book, played more international hockey matches than any human being ever. He played in 4 different Olympics. And he's like, yeah, I can't really remember the difference between the different games. I just remember the different clothes we wore at them. But what was thrilling, though, was because these events were so big, things like tanks rolling into the streets or playing the Soviets, you know, when you're representing your country in the only way your country can fight back, that made things a lot crisper in people's minds. It was something they thought about throughout their lives. And so what was really incredible was in a number of cases, I talked to people and, you know, it'd feel like kind of a casual conversation. And then we would turn to talking about the tanks rolling in or talking about fighting the Soviets on the ice. And all of a sudden, you could see their bodies tense up and they get tears in their eyes. It was amazing. And so a big part was, yeah, so capturing things that were really important to these people, you know, the biggest events of their lives. But also some of them also had memoirs And so I got a great translator who translated the memoirs, and then I was able to pull a lot of details from that as well.
That's great. You're mostly talking about the reporting aspect of it, but also in terms of research, how difficult was it, or was it not at all, to get your hands on some of these primary documents or just things that seem pretty obscure? Like, for instance, like who the person who ranked second in assists 1 year in 1965 in Czechoslovakia.
Yeah, that's a funny one, right? Because periodically I say this person had the third largest number of goals in the league season in Czechoslovakia in 1966. Believe it or not, that stuff was actually easier to get than you would think. First of all, the hockey world is pretty good at actually recording whatever it can. And people in Czechoslovakia, I mean, imagine this. I mean, it's not hard to get baseball statistics here, right? And that's, you know, people care so much about that stuff. And you see all sorts of things like people digging back into, you know, even non-major leagues, because it means so much to people to find stuff. That's, you know, hockey was that way for Czechoslovakia. People kept really copious records. So that part wasn't so hard. And I actually was really lucky in that this was a case where, because of how small a country it was relatively easy to actually find a large number of the important people and actually just get in touch with them and say, hey, I'm working on this book. Would you be willing to talk? Partly, you know, Czechoslovakia, I mean, for the most part, people in the West don't think that much about Czechoslovakia. So these are people who don't get that much attention from the West. So they were excited to talk to a Westerner who was writing a book about it. But at least as important, this was, you know, so many of them actually thanked me because this was such a big event in their country's life. So many of them said, thank you so much for working on this. This was the central event to us, you know, before our revolution, that this was so that the Soviets coming in shaped the lives of everybody, and these hockey matches shaped all of our lives. So that was actually pretty easy. Ultimately, I mean, some people didn't want to talk, and so I couldn't do anything about that. But the number one thing that made it all easier was very early on in the process, I found that there was a family, the Holík family, whom I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But the Holík family, it turned out, these two brothers were stars on the national hockey team and central to this story. Well, one of them had a son who went and played in the NHL and lives in the United States. And the first person I spoke to for this project was this former NHL star who then introduced me to his family. And from there, a lot was much easier too.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And you perfectly set me up to discuss the Holík family. So the narrative is weaved throughout, basically with the backbone, this family over the course of multiple generations, three generations, in fact. And the book documents the intergenerational trauma that the family felt at the hands of the Soviets' extremely oppressive, repressive regime. Why did you choose to tell this historical tale through various personal perspectives that spanned three generations? And why do you think it was so effective? I know I have opinions on that too.
Yeah. So, I mean, originally, so this was probably the hardest thing for me. I'm a nerdy political scientist, and, you know, my books, you know, my previous books are very nerdy, very theoretical, lots of, you know, broad history, things like that. And, you know, not very accessible for people who just want to read about something really cool. As I said, my first contact was with the Holíks, but it took me a little while to realize that I actually had to tell the story from a more personal angle. At first, I just thought the history of hockey in Czechoslovakia was so amazing, that it was this country where hockey was so central to fighting the Soviets, and hockey ended up even being central to the revolution, and hockey ended up being a thing that helped the country really find itself after, even, you know, as it was suffering, even after it became more democratic. So I thought that was enough. Well, pretty early on, when I started approaching agents, they were just sitting there going, why does somebody want to read about hockey in Czechoslovakia? That just doesn't seem that interesting to us. And so I started talking to my wife about it. And she said, what you're, you know, it seems like your actual goal is to write something more like Seabiscuit or Boys in the Boat, but you're not writing it like that. The great narrative nonfiction books, you know, the things that people that really draw people in, are really focused on individual human beings at extraordinary times. So you need to focus more on the individual human beings. Then all of a sudden I said, oh my gosh, this whole Leak family has had this extraordinary history, which actually also at the same time tells the story of this incredible country. And it's woven into this unbelievable story of hockey and sports fitting in with everything. And from there, actually, things became so much easier. Like, I got it. I said, oh, that's right. To make this story, to make people really get this story, I need to bring in the personal angle and tell about this unbelievable story of this family.
Yeah, that's really cool how you talk about that, because for me as a fellow nerd, I would have just thought maybe for me it would have been enough to read about the history, some play-by-play of the hockey games. Totally. Those were big games, but no, you went way further, and the book is way better for it. And,
thank you.
It will reach a broader audience for that reason. It's just such an intensely personal tale. Yeah. We don't just get to know these characters, but we get to know what makes them tick, what their ultimate goals are, what's devastating for them, how they are on a day-to-day basis, what they're thinking, what they're dreading, what they're afraid of, just everything really. And so, it's really obvious if you just read even a couple pages in, we're starting to get to know these characters and at different stages of life too, as people change and evolve.
Oh, hey, by the way, Aaron, can I just interrupt? That's really cool that you saw all that in the book. Thank you. That is awesome. That is how I intended to write it, but you never know. So that is awesome. Thank you.
No, my pleasure. I appreciate that. Just being honest and reflecting on my thoughts, just going through the book. But Yaroslav Jr., he's one of the major characters.
Yep.
I was interested to hear more about how you thought about the dynamic of accommodation versus resistance, because obviously we meet him as a boy where he has no filter pretty much. And he's in a repressive regime where that's frowned upon, to say the least. And he kind of gets away with a lot, it seems like, but he does have to evolve over the course of his life to make sure that he and his kids and just the rest of his family members are able to survive and thrive in this challenging society. How did you see the balance between those two things, accommodation and resistance, as he evolved throughout his life?
So first of all, yes, Yaroslav Holik is the center of this book. I mean, he is the central character, and he is one of the most incredible characters I have ever read about. And actually, my great regret is I didn't get to meet him. He had died a couple years before I started doing the research. In a way, I guess I'm a little glad, because he sounded so intimidating. I think I would have been a little scared in interviewing him. But yes, this is a kid. He grew up during World War II when the Nazis occupied Czechoslovakia. And so he had that scary upbringing. Then the Soviets helped liberate Czechoslovakia. So at first he was living in a free society, but by the time he was, 6 years old, he was 5.5 years old. Communism, took over, the communists took over in Czechoslovakia. And here was this kid who was supposed to keep quiet and not say anything bad about the communists. His parents said, please don't say anything, because we could get sent to prison if you say the wrong thing. And he just walked around saying the bleeping communists. He had no filter, exactly as you said. And he grew up with exactly that. I can say and do whatever I want. At first, it was just because that's who he was. Over time, he kind of developed this mantra, which is become too good to be denied. And if you are so good at something that, people care about, then nobody can touch you. And so he decided, hey, I'm going to be so great at hockey that no one can touch me. And that's what he thought for a long time, that he was such a great hockey player. He became star of the local region. He became star of his club team, of the army team. And then he became the star and leader of the national team. And he thought, therefore, you know, people would say, oh, you should join the Communist Party, you'll get benefits. And he said, no, I don't have to do that. If you're good enough at hockey, no one will do anything to you. Well, periodically, he got into trouble. He actually twice got kicked off the national team for things he did, but he still didn't care. He was not willing to, you know, to accommodate in any way. And so that was all working great for him. He continued to push along doing whatever he wanted, just feeling like, I'm fine, I'm untouchable. And then it was when the government started to threaten his kids. There was one thing in particular where he got into a shouting match with a big Communist Party official. And he cursed out the communist official, and he got brought in to see first the hockey leaders, but then the leaders of the Communist Party. And they said, if you want to protect your children, you will never say another word. You will shut up and you will apologize. And from then on, he was really careful. He became much more, you know, up to that point, he had been willing to do anything. He'd been willing to curse out the Soviets and the communists at home. But once it came down to his kids, he was willing to accommodate and shut his mouth and do what they wanted. So the big thing was, you know, it's funny. It's I can tell you as a parent, once you start, you know, thinking about your kids, you do things very differently. You're willing to take risks for yourself, but not for your kids.
Yeah. Just going back for a second to the style that you wrote the book in, given that you're an academic it seems like a lot of the stuff you've written in recent years has been more of the academic variety, was writing with such vivid imagery and developing characters and building suspense and those types of narrative devices a muscle that you had to kind of develop or something that you had done in the past, but something that you had to remind yourself of how to do, really?
The hardest part really was the thing, realizing at first that was necessary to bring in. That, as you know, as we talked about, you know, a minute ago, I mean, I just thought the story was cool and I didn't need to bring in individual characters and suspense and all that. But once I realized that this needed to be a story about humans and drama, for some reason, it wasn't that hard for me. I really love storytelling. I love telling stories and I love building suspense. For some reason, I guess that was something I just sort of practiced, not in writing, but in speaking. And so I just felt really comfortable with it. And actually, more than anything, I'd been feeling locked up in the kind of writing I've been doing as an academic. And I really yearned to write something exciting and dramatic and suspense filled. So I think in that case, it was just something I really wanted to do.
That's cool. It sounds like it was kind of like a release in some ways.
Oh, so much. It was so fun. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, you did so much in-depth reporting too. So I think that when you meet all these people, you talk to them and their kids and their parents and everything, and you really start to know them. So it's just like you have this rich source of information that you have to tap into, and then it's just figuring out how to lay it out.
And actually, I mean, I talked earlier, right, about, you know, how seeing people getting really emotional as they told their stories. And so I really wanted to convey that emotion and, you know, what they were feeling along the way. So that was really, really wonderful. By the way, one other thing I did that was really cool in the reporting is the Czech Republic rebroadcasts these games. And what they do is they have the players who played in them come in and comment while watching the games. And so you can actually hear their reflections as they watch what they were doing. And so that's incredible, is having them talk sort of in real time about what was going through their heads, what they were trying to do. And one of my favorite parts, though, was an interview I did where I talked to a guy who scored a game-winning goal. And he talked in such detail about the feeling that came over him. He said, you know, he talked about, it was the same feeling I have with every winning goal ever. It just happened to be this one was in the World Championship. And I felt this wave of relaxation and tingling come over my body. I'm like, whoa, that's totally cool. I can't wait to put that in there. Yeah.
Yeah, so poetic. And you also are detailing what the crowd is doing, what they're saying, the whistles, the types of whistles. How do you have access to that? Is that from the footage or yeah. your reporting or a combination of this?
Exactly. So what I had, some reporting, some things from newspapers could, I couldn't see the signs being held up in the crowd very well, but there was some newspaper reporting on that. But as I mentioned, I had an interpreter in the Czech Republic who, you know, helped with the live interviews, but I worked with an amazing professor of political science here. His name is Pavel Bachovsky. He's a professor right now at Bates College. He was getting his PhD at Boulder at the time. And Pavel is Czech and a massive hockey fan. And I asked if he'd be willing to help me with the project. And so he did amazing translations of everything. I watched all the games. And so I could hear things, and so I could hear when things were going on. But what he did, he also translated things like the chants going on. And mm-hmm. so he would tell me exactly what the crowd was screaming out at any given moment. And that was amazing to bring in.
So invaluable for the narrative. You often cite that. And really, it's about the broader culture and the people way more than just what's happening on the ice. So I think that's really important and really cool.
It was really amazing.
The imagery is just so vivid, as I mentioned before. Just things that stood out to me, some random examples. The good luck charm that the actress puts, she puts a button in her mouth, I believe, because both of her hands are occupied and she's afraid she's going to swallow it during excitement for the game. But it's just important for her to just keep it in her mouth the whole
amazing.
Game.
Yes, that was a great moment.
You just really get a sense of just like she's on pins and needles, not wanting to swallow this button. Also, another thing that I thought it was important imagery and really said a lot about the differences between the Soviet team and the Czechoslovakian team was just your description of their different uniforms and how the USSR, their team, it was just all the same, and the color of their helmet, how they wore their hair, everything. And the Czechoslovakian team, they were just all over the place. It was just like any one player couldn't have been more different than the player standing next to.
Yeah, that was one of the things. So, I mean, I watched these games over and over and over again. And at first, I didn't notice little nuances. But over time, you know, I really wanted to tell the story. I wanted people to feel like they were there. I mean, it was so exciting and so meaningful. And the first time I watched any of them, I didn't really notice that much that was really that interesting. But as I slowed down and really checked it out, yeah, that was so interesting that there were these things going on. And well, I'm so glad you felt that those really added, because I really wanted people to kind of really get a sense of the excitement and the emotion and the differences between these people. And one of the things that took me forever in watching the games over and over and watching little things going on was I didn't notice it until, I don't know, the 10th time I watched one of the big games. But one of the Soviet players was skating off at the ice, flipping his hand underneath his chin to say, screw you. I mean, it was kind of subtle, though, but it's such an amazing moment. So, yeah, these all these details were just amazing to come across.
One thing I was also impressed by, you probably are a much bigger hockey fan than me, correct me if I'm wrong, but I just thought how many different ways that you could say kind of a similar type thing in terms of the hockey play-by-play, just in a descriptive, non-repetitive way. Was that challenging? Fun?
It was incredibly challenging. How'd you approach that? That was really hard. Actually, I'm not a massive hockey fan, so that was especially challenging. I mean, in particular, the hardest thing was how many ways can you say puck? You know, if you're talking about other sports, it's easy enough to transition, you know, come up with different, you know, words for ball. Puck, they're relatively few. So yeah, that was actually harder for me. That was one of the trickier parts.
Did you ask for help and consult with hockey people, or,
you know, that's something I didn't get around. I should have. I mean, I had people who, you know, read hockey, but I didn't ask any hockey, you know, hockey writers or anything. That actually would have been helpful.
talking more about specific scenes that resonated with me. Actually, we'll get back to the monumental 5-4 victory over the Soviets in the 1968 Winter Olympics in a second. But just to better set the scene for that, the Prague Spring that began in 1968 under Dubček, I'm just going to run through my basic understanding of it, but please provide more context, correct anything that I say wrong, and just help us get into it a little bit more. So essentially, my understanding is when he took over, once Novotny was forced out, there were a number of measures that were introduced that had to do with freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of movement, those types of things, where it was a softening of the Soviet Union, their hardline stance on everything. And it seemed like freedoms just in general were being increased and things were opening up. But there was a push and pull. The people wanted more and the Soviets began cracking down, and it ultimately culminated in a violent and poorly organized Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. So just react to that and paint a picture of what was going on at that time, if you can, for me.
Sure. And just to go back a tiny bit. So the Soviets had helped Czechoslovakia become free after World War II, helped free them from the Germans. And then very quickly, the Soviets backed a coup where basically the communists had, you know, had taken over the government in Czechoslovakia, but they had ruled relatively democratically for a little bit, but all of a sudden they felt pressure to do more. And so they became this oppressive regime, taking away people's property, like the Holík family butcher shop. They not only imprisoned tons of people, they were putting people to death. And you could be imprisoned for saying the wrong things. I mean, it was a horrible, horrible place to live. You know, at first people had been sort of happy with the Soviets because they'd helped free them after World War II. Well, by the late 1960s, people were kind of sick of a lot. They were sick of hearing all the time about how great the Soviets were. So there was all this propaganda in Czechoslovakia. Oh, the Soviets are the best at everything. And people were really getting sick of this. And they were getting sick of constantly being told they were, you know, the little brother to the Soviet Union. And in fact, at one point, the communists in Czechoslovakia had imprisoned the national hockey team of Czechoslovakia and sent two guys and sentenced them to 15 years in the uranium mines. So people actually thought that the Soviets had forced their hockey team to die so that the Soviet team could become good. And so as time went by and Czechoslovakia had a hockey team again, people thought they weren't allowed to beat the Soviets. So this was all part of this sense in Czechoslovakia of, you know, the Soviets are keeping us down and they're using the communists to do it. And so there was this increasing kind of negative feeling against the Soviets and wanting to push back. And in the 1967 World Ice Hockey Championships, when Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia played, thanks in part to our good friend Jaroslav Holík, there was a massive brawl between the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia. And people back in Czechoslovakia were talking about it. They were saying nasty things about the Soviets, calling the Soviet embassy, saying, "You cheaters." And the Soviets were really worried. So there was a lot of tension at this time between the countries, and it was made worse because of this hockey stuff, or made more intense. So yeah, eventually Alexander Dubček comes into power in 1968 and is pushing for more freedom in Czechoslovakia. And people are rejoicing in Czechoslovakia. They think this is wonderful. And the Soviets quickly get very concerned. And yes, in August of 1968, the Soviets send in 500,000 troops and thousands of tanks to crush it all. So I think that covers, I think that kind of fills in any little cracks.
Yeah, and am I remembering this correctly? In 1967, the Czechoslovakian team beat the Soviets in the World Championships, but they had never beaten the Soviets in the Olympics?
So the only time before 1968, Czechoslovakia had ever beaten the Soviets in major international hockey play was 1961. And okay. So starting in 1963, the Soviets won Soviets by 1960
every single
were
time.
Great in hockey. And so they won every world championship. And so 1967, the Soviets won and there was the big brawl. So
okay,
by 1968, we start getting more freedom in Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
And people start wondering, hey, are we allowed to beat the Soviets now as they go to play them in the 1968 Olympics?
So it's in front of this backdrop that the 1968 Olympics occur, and the Czech team just has this epic 5-4 victory.
It's just, oh my gosh, we beat the Soviets. Now, the downside is the next, a couple days later, they play Sweden in the last game, and
really anticlimactic.
And they can't pull it. And this is something that happens multiple times. Czechoslovakia plays Sweden, and something not good happens for Czechoslovakia. So the Soviets won the 1968 gold medal. But Czechoslovakia was so happy to have beaten the Soviets. And this was a people actually got a sense of, you know what? We actually seem to have real freedom now. We even are allowed to beat the Soviets. Like, they actually believed that.
Yeah. And I thought it was funny. It was such a monumental, bigger than sports victory that it seemed like no one really even necessarily cared that much that they got silver and the Soviets got gold. It's just they beat the Soviets.
Yes,
and that was kind of like the big takeaway.
Exactly.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more show.
Hey, this is Andy Liu from the Light Years Podcast, coming to you from On the NBA Beat.
This is Sekou Smith of NBA TV, NBA.com, and the Hang Time Podcast. You're doing the right thing if you're listening to On the NBA Beat.
So more along these lines, that was a perfect example of the transformative power and influence of sports. This clearly wasn't just merely a hockey game. This is demonstrated throughout the narrative. A couple, I think, poignant examples that I want to reference. One of them was just talking about how fans could react in the crowd. And I'm quoting you here, there was no safe way to openly vent about the Soviet Union's grip on the country. Sports offered that. And I think when you're living in a regime and you're not really allowed to speak out much, and everything is really tightly regulated, I just think that's really cool and special that these fans could just let loose and yell all kinds of nasty stuff in the crowd and just use a sporting event as an outlet in that way.
Well, that was so amazing. It became really clear how important that was in 1972. So in 1972, Czechoslovakia hosts the World Ice Hockey Championships. And it was in that year that it became really, really clear that after the Soviets had come in 1968 and eventually pushed for this really hardline communist regime in Czechoslovakia at that point, by 1972, Czechoslovakia was a police state. And so you actually had cameras, you know, monitors in the hockey arena, so that security forces could monitor what the crowd was doing. In the, you know, were they doing anything they shouldn't be? And they would whisk people out if they saw anybody behaving, you know, in a way they didn't like. And they had so-called secret police sitting in the front row all around the glass to, you know, right between the seating and the ice. So you've got all these security forces there, but at the same time, you could have people, you couldn't say anything nasty about the communists, but you could cheer for your team and you could, you know, whistle down the opposing team. And that was a form of resistance. That was really cool.
Yeah. The other example I wanted to cite was just how important sports was growing up in a communist society. Yaroslav Sr. told his sons Yuri and Yaroslav Jr., if you want to get anywhere in life, you have to play a sport. It won't happen any other way. It's just so interesting how it was just drilled into them from such an early age.
Yeah, it incredible in Czechoslovakia, because people's lives were really hard under communism. And if you joined the Communist Party, you could get a lot of advantages, a lot of benefits that other people couldn't. But if you weren't doing that, if you were a star athlete, you could get so many things that other people couldn't. I mean, in part, you could just be freer than other people could. I mean, as we saw with Yaroslav Halík, you could speak your mind much more freely. But also, one of the things that a number of the older guys I interviewed said, you know what? most people could only get bananas once a year. We could get bananas almost whenever we wanted. I mean, it was just simple things like that that we take for granted that only the athletes could get special permission for. Yeah, so being an athlete in these countries was so important because it was so huge to communist propaganda to have good sports teams.
Mm-hmm. And you also cite a few historical examples of Czechoslovakia essentially being abandoned by Western powers, including the United States. And I think that goes back to something you referenced early on in the conversation, that not a lot of attention is paid to the Czech Republic or Slovakia or Czechoslovakian history, especially from the West. And I'll just read a quick quote that I think was important to introduce this topic. "Once again, to keep the stable, peaceful global balance, the world sacrificed the little country to the whims of a superpower." And I believe that was in 1968 that you're talking about.
Yeah.
When that crackdown that I referenced, we referenced a little earlier, and there was this uneasy peace between the Soviets and the U.S. and Western powers, Cold War, where is it worth it to step in and help the Czechoslovakian people if it's going to risk disrupting this uneasy balance? And then even before that, the Marshall Plan after World War II, and just letting Stalin and the Soviets assert their control over Czechoslovakia. So I guess I'd love you to talk about how that kind of shaped the Czechoslovakian identity, just feeling like they're repeatedly being abandoned by Western powers. And then also, what lessons or takeaways do you think from those key moments that the U.S. and the West more broadly can learn or take away from those events with regard to the deadly conflict between Russia and Ukraine today?
Yeah, so a lot in what you just brought up. I mean, there's also another quote from the book. It's not my words, but it's actually when the Nazis were, when Germany, before World War II, was thinking of taking over a good chunk of Czechoslovakia, the British Prime Minister went on the radio and said, you know, Neville Chamberlain is famous for having said that they would do nothing to help Czechoslovakia. If anything, they would give up Czechoslovakia, let Czechoslovakia be taken over by the Nazis in order to help with peace. And what he said specifically is, you know, we're not going to do all sorts of things. And this is a quote, because of a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. Mm-hmm. And so throughout their history, the people of Czechoslovakia were known as a people of whom the rest of the world knew nothing. And that's, yeah, that was devastating. I mean, this was a thing that, you know, because they were a small country, they were in the middle of the continent where lots of countries or lots of powers wanted to take over them. Czechoslovakia was always in this position. And, you know, the small countries throughout the world have experienced this, you know, for centuries. So one thing is, that's just something that actually a lot of the world has experienced, in Czechoslovakia particularly painfully so. And so the funny thing is, just to bring it over to sports for a second, that actually makes stuff like sports extra important. And so I'll give you an example. I was speaking to one of the amazing things, any place I go when I'm doing research, the best thing is talking to taxi cab drivers. They'll tell you anything. You can learn so much from taxi cab drivers. And so there was this one driver in Prague who was talking all about her obsession with hockey. And she talked about how much she loved hockey. And she said at one point, it's just that we're such a small country that, and we have so many fewer people than everywhere else, that any kind of medal just means so much to us. And she started crying. So things like sporting events, you know, the world forgets about these places. And so it's things like sporting events for little countries that makes the world, you know, not only remember that they exist, but that they matter. And it makes it, you know, maybe there's less of a chance that we'll be, you know, run over by others. So yeah, when we get around to Ukraine, you asked about Ukraine. So during the Cold War, nobody was going to do anything about Czechoslovakia. Nobody was going to protect Czechoslovakia from the Soviets, because during the Cold War, we'd agreed that the Soviets get their sphere. They get to control these countries, and we're not going to do anything about them, just as long as, you know, they don't come in and do anything to the countries in our area. So that was never going to happen. But now that we're past the Cold War, you know, those lines aren't drawn in the same way. And so when Russia threatens a country like Ukraine, in essence, it's threatening more of, you know, the West side. And so that's why I think we end up seeing more, you know, support, although, you know, kind of unsteady support, but we see more support for protecting Ukraine. But you also still have these people saying, you know, we shouldn't do anything for people of whom we know nothing.
Right.
But I'll say two of the countries that have most strongly supported Ukraine have been the Czech Republic and Slovakia. They have been so supportive, so incredibly outspokenly so, saying we need to do all we can to protect Ukraine. So as far as lessons we could draw, look, you know, these countries, you know, filled with people of whom we know nothing, they're pretty significant in terms of our, you know, what things can mean for us. When Hitler invaded a good chunk of Czechoslovakia, that was actually foreshadowing of a lot of other things he was going to do. So we should actually be careful to pay attention to these countries.
Right. Aside from it just being the right thing to do to protect a people that peace-loving people that are just trying to go about their own lives without outside aggression, it also, as you said, affects us, and it can balloon into something a lot worse and more expansive. Speaking of Russian aggression and what that means going down the line in terms of enabling that aggressive and hostile and deadly behavior. The 1946, I think, democratic rise of the communists is also something that's important to study. And you talk about it briefly, but the Communist Party won free and fair elections. They won something like, I think it was 38% of the vote, way more than any other party. And they were seen generally positively by the electorate at that time for various reasons that you mentioned already in this discussion. And then pretty quickly it slid from democracy into autocracy. And talk about how precarious democracy can be and how vigilant people have to be to prevent backsliding and what that means potentially for us in our moment in time.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the single thing I probably care about more than anything in politics right now. Yes, we are living in an incredibly precarious time where we are in danger of lots of countries. Lots of countries are in mid-backslide. The United States is in danger of backsliding. And it's really hard. You know, we tend to think of, you know, democracy is falling apart because a bunch of people in the streets, you know, start chanting and come in and run roughshod over those in power. And then suddenly, you know, and grab the gavel and say, OK, we're in charge now, you know, sort of Dr. Evil style. But more common, what happens is people gain power through free and fair, you know, fair elections, but then use the instruments of power to completely undercut democracy. And so that's a big fear that people have about could be happening in the next few years in the United States, people fear. That's certainly what happened in Czechoslovakia, that in Czechoslovakia in 1948, the communists had come in through free elections, and then they moved to essentially tell everybody who was not a communist, look, you need to either start working with us or you could be in really big trouble. And they started threatening the country and threatening to use the military might of the country and get the Soviets to come, you know, use violence to crush people until they went along with the communist regime. So yeah, it really is an argument for vigilance and really paying attention to what people can use with governmental power to completely undercut democracy. It's terrifying.
Yeah, I agree. And of course, these broader implications for today are not explicitly talked about in the book, but I do think that what you wrote about raised a lot of those issues, and it's something that's on my mind a lot. And I don't care about getting political. This conversation is political, and politics are important. When you have a former president say something like the press is the enemy of the people, I just think that if something like that is enabled, or if that individual is reelected, that kind of says, I think, all that needs to be said. But also, I mean, January 6th, seeking to invalidate free and fair election results, I think it's just a dangerous game, a slippery slope. So things like that were on my mind just reading about, even though it was just kind of a small part of the book. I just thought it was interesting and informative, just how the communists took over and it was a free and fair election. And there was a democracy at that point. Didn't last long, but there was one.
I'm glad you noticed that, actually, because the whole time I was writing, actually, the reason I was so drawn to this topic more than any other is I was writing it right as I was terrified about the collapse of democracy. And I still am, for that matter. And so I paid particular attention to things that kind of had parallels to the world we live in today. And so one thing I commented on was that the communists and the Soviet Union, led by Joseph Stalin, made a point of talking about the press as the enemy of the people. And I wanted to highlight the parallel there. And I wanted to highlight, too, the ways that, you know, as you said, the former president is actually the plan he is speaking openly of is undercutting a lot of democratic rules and a lot of rule of law if he's reelected. And so I wanted to highlight in the book, what does that mean when you actually lose democratic power and you actually undercut, you know, democratic constitution and you eliminate freedom? What kind of world does that look like for your country? So I'm glad you noticed all that. And it's a terrifying world, by the way. It's a really scary one once you undercut democracy.
Yeah. We're learning that. In the interest of time, and you know I could talk forever about this with you, and I've really enjoyed the conversation and hope that people check out the book. But I did want to close with a question about that scene that I really felt it. I felt all the feels. I just got chills when Vaclav Havel and Dubček, they emerge onto the balcony, and there are hundreds of thousands of demonstrators filling Wenceslas. Am I saying right? Wenceslas Square. Below them, and I think it was so impactful. Just talk a little bit about what's going on in Czechoslovakian history at that point. And also standing on the shoulders of giants too. I think about that too, because those two figures were pretty important. And a lot of these demonstrators are the younger generation, and they kind of, you could in a sense argue that they finished the job that these two important people started many decades earlier, but were kind of marginalized and put on the side, and then they were able to come back victorious, and it was kind of like an intergenerational collaborative effort to emerge victorious. And I think that also so brings this all full circle that gives you another meaning for freedom to win.
Yeah, no, completely. The chapter on the revolution, I got chills. Thank you so much. I'm so glad you felt that way reading that. I got chills just learning about the whole experience. And some of the research I did was incredible in researching the revolution. The first time I went to Prague, the first day I spent in Prague, I went to Wenceslas Square, which is where the major demonstrations would occur in Prague, but also the heart of the revolution occurred. And I had chills just walking around that square. It was this beautiful September day. Incredible. So Alexander Dubček had been leading a freer country for Czechoslovakia until 1969. So the Soviets had come in 68. Dubček had tried to create a more free world for his people, but the Soviets came in and crushed it. They didn't want Czechoslovakia to be freer. One of the things that blew my mind, the way in which politics and sports continue to overlap with this story, just I couldn't not write this book. It was too extraordinary. So after one of the big matches between Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union, incredible match in the 1969 World Ice Hockey Championships, 500,000 people in Czechoslovakia take to the streets, and hundreds of thousands of them go to this Wenceslas Square in Prague. And at first, they're just celebrating the excitement of the match against the Soviets, and then they quickly turn to violence. They start destroying things Soviet. They destroyed the Soviet airline office. As a result of this, the Soviets started calling it the hockey riots and said that Dubček couldn't be in power anymore because he couldn't control his people. And basically, from that point on, he was lucky not to be killed. Basically, the Soviets thought about killing him and they didn't. But they basically made him an outcast. He couldn't do anything. So for the next 20 years, he was off by himself. People essentially weren't allowed to talk to him, the leader of the freedom movement in Czechoslovakia. So years go by. And finally, in 1989, we start seeing pushback against communism, push for democracy around Eastern Europe, and the Soviet Union starting to go along with it. And Czechoslovakia, meanwhile, had a dissident, a guy who was trying to push back against the communist forces, Václav Havel, who had been a playwright, and he was constantly getting into trouble with the communists, and he got imprisoned, but he continued to try and organize against the communists throughout. Well, 1989, as communism starts falling around Eastern Europe, people in Czechoslovakia start going, maybe this time we're finally going to get freedom. And it all culminates in November as hundreds of thousands of people are taking to the streets. And there's this moment that is incredible for me. So it even drifts into hockey, where the captain of the Prague hockey team skates out to the center ice right before a game his team is supposed to play. And the revolution by this point has started. And he reads a speech to the crowd in the hockey arena. And by the way, I interviewed this guy. This was one of the most incredible interviews I did, because he reenacted certain things he did during this. And all of a sudden, with, I think it was 13,000 people all staring and listening to him, he starts singing the national anthem. And so I was there. He's singing the national anthem for me. And so I could describe his voice because he sang this song for me. And he had a beautiful voice. And so in front of 13,000 people who are totally silent, as this revolution is beginning, this man sings the national anthem basically in support of the people pushing the revolution. And as he finishes, I mean, people are crying. I talked to people who were there who saw this, and they had tears in their eyes as they were describing it to me. And he finishes the national anthem, and the crowd starts chanting, "Freedom, freedom, freedom," which is incredible at a sporting event. So with this, people are increasingly taking to the streets, to Wenceslas Square, where the protesters are really going. And one of the things that was wild in this book, you talked about the hockey crowd chanting Dubček over and over. This was in 1969 in Sweden. So the Swedish crowd was chanting Dubček during these hockey matches, Czechoslovakia against the Soviet Union, in support of Czechoslovakia. They wanted to know, look, we're in support of your freedom. We don't want the Soviets doing this to you. So, thousands of people in this Swedish arena are chanting Dubček. Well, the way I describe it is we've heard this chant before when we get to 1989, as now there are hundreds of thousands of people in Wenceslas Square, and they start chanting Dubček, Dubček, Dubček over and over. And he steps out, Dubček does, steps out onto this balcony in Wenceslas Square as 300,000 people are chanting his name. And so he hasn't been seen for 20 years. And he's this symbol of hope, and they're chanting his name. And, it's this moment. He had planned on reading some remarks, but he's so touched by the moment. He pantomimes embracing the crowd. And then this other guy, Václav Havel, who was leading the push for freedom in Czechoslovakia, stands out with Havel. And the two of them are standing in front of a third of a million people who are chanting, Dubček, Havel, Dubček, Havel. It's a stunning moment. And you can watch video of this, by the way. It's incredible. You can find video. And then the crowd, everybody, these third of a million people take out their keys and start jangling them. Partly it's a sound of the bells tolling for the communists. And partly it is, hey, it's time for you to go home. Take your keys and get out of here. It's an incredible moment. Yes. So I loved writing that.
Just a spectacular story amid a broader spectacular story that I'm grateful that you told for all of us. And this was just an absolute pleasure to reconnect with you in this way and to share our conversation with our listeners. And I hope that many of you check it out if you have a chance, and we'll post the link too on the show notes. But thank you so much again for doing this, Ethan.
Thank you so much. This was a blast. It was fantastic chatting. It was fantastic getting back in touch. And also, I know some people are more audiobook kinds of people. There's now an audiobook which just came out this week, so that's another option as well.
That's good to know. I know a lot of people like to consume books in that medium
too.
So
definitely
cool.
But thanks again, Ethan. So great, and thank you so much for all the kind words.
Of course.